둘, 셋, 파!
For Hey Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Hello, and welcome to Long Time No See, the podcast. Each week, we'll be pairing two blindfolded comedians who've agreed to sit down with a mystery guest. I'll be putting them on the spot with a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Without further ado, please remove your blindfolds and introduce yourself.
Hey, I'm Michael.
Hi, Andrea.
I have to be honest with you, I am so relieved to see it's you.
Do you have any irrational fears? What's the worst fad you were into? Is there any job that you would be terrible at?
Underwater welder?
Don't say that about yourself.
Do you guys have any useless talents?
I kicked one of those delivery robots.
Got what? You kicked one?
Yelling. I kick those all the time.
They have names on them.
Good.
I can make smoke come out of my mouth with nothing.
Do it.
You want to see it?
What the f***? Are you a dragon?
Out now, Long Time No See the Podcast, Season 2. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Welcome to Going There, the crossroads where music and mental health meet. Presented by Consequence Podcast Network and SoundMind Live, this series is made possible by the fine folks at Janssen Pharmaceutical Companies of Johnson & Johnson. On today's episode, we are thrilled to be talking with Nick Hexum, singer, guitarist, and songwriter of the band 311. Now, this has been a special year for Nick, personally and professionally. Not only did Nick just celebrate his 50th birthday, but also 311 reached the milestone of 30 years together as a band. And during that time, 311 has released 13 albums and given us hits such as Down, All Mixed Up, and my personal favorite, a stellar interpretation of The Cure's Love Song. Now on the Going There podcast, our goal is to shine a light on the incredibly difficult topic of mental illness so we can all come out of the darkness and get the care we need. So we talk with musicians who struggle with their mental health just like us. And we have in-depth conversations asking the tough questions so we can learn from each other and put an end to the stigma of mental illness. Now, over the course of his life and career, Nick has really stepped up and been willing to share his struggles with how he copes with mental health issues. In fact, about a year ago, I had the pleasure of interviewing Nick about how he coped with stress and worked to maintain his mental health. And what was so striking was the depth and focus of his process of coping with anxiety. Nick has spent years, through personal exploration and therapy, grounding himself in an active, thorough, and deliberate process that involves gratitude, learning to accept and tolerate intense negative emotion, and a focus on identifying and challenging toxic negative thoughts. So let's go there and check out what Nick has to say. Okay, Nick, welcome. Welcome to Going There.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Now, you and I have talked before, and it was a great conversation. I really appreciated all the ideas that you've had on how to take care of yourself, how to take care of one's mental health. And I thought what we would start with is something that you and I talked about a little bit before the podcast, which was just struggling with anxiety. Now, anxiety can manifest in different ways for different people. And so, you know, I'm kind of curious just how that has played out in your life.
I think looking back now, since I just had my 50th birthday earlier this year, you know, it's at first I had such a real drive for attention and kind of something to prove. Very highly risk tolerant, very ambitious. And then after I kind of started to get that attention that I craved, I would start to feel like, but now what if I can't, what if self-doubt, what if I can't sustain the attention that I've craved? And like, what if I freeze up? What if I just going through these what ifs, as you know, it's kind of obvious, like, and then seeking help and support, and sort of the cognitive behavioral therapy type solutions of counteracting those type of feelings of self-doubt by getting into writing, doing like morning pages through this you know, thing called the Artist's Way, which is just getting to know yourself and then building self-esteem so I feel like I can handle things that come, you know, getting into self-care. But you know, it's a long time coming. It's a journey that's never over. I mean, I love psychology, just coming from a family of psychologists, as we talked about in that interview that we did before. And I see how many traits that I have, that my grandfather had, and, just, it's this journey of self-discovery.
Now, when you talk about anxiety, anxiety can manifest in so many different ways. You know, some people, they have panic attacks, and some people, they worry, other people obsess, or and some people are just like more generally keyed up. And I'm kind of curious if you're comfortable just for you, like how did you know you were anxious? Like, what, how did that play out for you?
I think it's, you know, I wrote a song in like, on the album Sound System called Mind Spin, and it's about the mind spinning and repetitive thoughts and, you know, these what ifs that just keep coming. And then it kind of can lead to insomnia. You know, I think that there was a lot of the song Flowing from our the same album Sound System was talking about just being awake and thinking of what ifs. And it was kind of, I guess that would, I would have been 29 at that time. So that was sort of a transition time from like the young fearlessness to like, okay, I'm an actual grown up now, and just the beginning of that self-discovery. But I don't think I had like full on panic attacks, but I'm more about getting into needless worry and then wanting to like self-medicate because I didn't have, you know, tools, you know, even though I had had a lot of psychologists in my life, I'd never really, you know, asked for help from myself. I was always like this guy, I got it, I got it, I got it. And then finally like, okay, I don't got it. And, you know, that's when you go through that portal of going from unteachable to teachable, it's something that you, you know, I never want to go back to, that place of, I don't know, lacking humility to, I always want to remain teachable and always, you know, keep reaching out and keep different things going in my life for self-care that, you know, makes life manageable.
And one of the things that you're talking about with the spinning thoughts, that what if is so dangerous. And the thing that's so dangerous about it is that it seems so harmless. But what you're really doing, not you, but all of us do, is we're presenting non-falsifiable catastrophic scenarios in our head. You know, and I've heard when I work with people saying, well, you know, what if I jump out the window? What if I embarrass myself in front of a big group of people? And the problem is that those are all reasonable questions on some level, but you can't prove that they're wrong. And so what's your mind left to do other than stay up? And I think that for somebody like yourself, when you're talking about from fearless to fearful, the people that sometimes have the toughest time with that are the can-do people, because they're used to being able to solve problems. And all of a sudden now you've got this problem and you can't solve it, but you don't know why.
Yeah. Yeah, I think besides future tripping, which is kind of what were alluding to there, I would also get into regret about, you know, in one of our famous lyrics from All Mixed Up, trust your instincts and let go of regret. And that's not just because I always knew to let go of regret. It's something that I would be like, you know, why did I say that to this person? Or how did I make that mistake? And just, you know, this sort of self-flagellating kind of thinking that is tough to get out of. And then when it comes to future tripping, it took me a long time until I could get to a place of like, I'll know how to handle it when I get there. I'll know what to do when I get there, because, you know, you just have to stop yourself at some point, because you can easily stay in that repetitive thing. And then I also, you know, I've never been, you know, diagnosed bipolar, but I know that I go through these kind of swings where at certain times everything is easy, I'm excited, you know, total confidence, and other times I'm just not feeling it. And I would say I've also, like I said, I get into a lot of writing where I would kind of write down, you know, a mood tracking kind of thing, and where I give myself that space where it's okay to not be okay. You know what I mean? Like, okay, I'm going through a bit of a slump right now, and maybe just the bare minimum today is acceptable. And then getting into reminding myself of that I'm doing a good job, because it can become pretty easy to focus on self-criticism, and that's not a fun place to be.
Well, you know, one of the things that's so tough, obviously, for people who have full-blown, whether it's a depression or a manic episode or a panic attack, is obviously it's so powerful, and it's so overwhelming, and the suffering is so great. But one of the things that a lot of people sometimes take for granted is that these more minor fluctuations, you know, like, so for example, you're talking about cycling from something where you're more up versus more down, that can be really difficult, not only because it kind of takes you off your game, but because it's hard to know, like, is this a problem? Like, am I just feeling energetic? Did I just not sleep well? And it makes it that much harder to be able to say, oh, there's something happening and I need to get help for it.
Yeah, no, it's true. And then deciding like what kind of help is appropriate. But for me, just getting into reaching out to both, you know, support from, you know, friends that I have, that where we really get super honest with each other. You know, I have guys that I would really deep heart-to-heart check-ins, and that's become especially needed during this time of forced isolation of a pandemic. But then, and also, I just am a huge proponent of therapy, you know, because there's certain things that where I need the big guns to be helped with. You know, it's been a very crazy time. And I think that it's, the more people admit that things are kind of tough right now, the better, because it's been such a divided time, and there's just so much fear. We have no idea when, you know, economically things are going to open up, and you just have to really use your tools to get through life right now. And that means telling people how you feel and being there for others, because you know, most of the best healing comes from trying to help other people, you know. So I'll reach out to somebody first to see how they're doing, but I also kind of want to share how I'm doing. But you know, it needs to be kind of a balanced support thing that we have with our friends and loved ones, where we're both there for each other.
You know, it's interesting, because we're talking about, you know, the anxieties you were feeling back when you were starting out, you know, as a performer, and you know, as your star was rising, and now all the way to now, you know, it's your 50th birthday. 311 just celebrated its 30th anniversary, 30 years of 311, I saw online. And, yeah, you know, I think that one of the things that's so striking about this time is that so much of the management of anxiety is predicated on the management of catastrophic thinking, you know, yeah. that like, and the one of the things that I think a lot of people are struggling with right now is that there are a lot of catastrophic thoughts that would have previously seemed, I don't like the term pathological, I don't like the term irrational, but let's just use that for a moment, that now all of a sudden seem like, well, maybe, like,
yeah,
you know, maybe that could happen. You know, yeah. and I'm kind of curious for you in your journey, because you're talking about having managed those conditions a while back to now, it seems like the lay of the land has changed a little bit.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good point, that previously it was just more of a mental exercise to stop from, you know, going to a worst case scenario, you know, catastrophizing, that type of thing. And now there is a question of, like, you know, are things going to go up in flames, both metaphorically and literally, you know? And there was a time last week when there was, you know, fires, three days in a row, we had fires that luckily were put out around my house. But then when you add to that, just uncertainty in society, financially, I have no idea when we're, you know, able to go back to work. But, you know, just trying to keep it in perspective, like, that there are people that are dealing with way worse things. So keeping myself from going too dark. But this is a very different time. I mean, back in the 90s, I felt out of step with music because there was so much angst and anger. And I was like, what is everybody so mad about? You know, this is such a time of prosperity. You know, it was after the fall of the Soviet Union. Because in the 80s, we were like, there could be a nuclear war. And, you know, and then all of a sudden we had no enemies. And it was like this wonderful, you know, time of peace and prosperity. Yet there was something where culture needed to complain and be angry, and I felt out of step with it. But now there are more real problems that are it seems like a more difficult time, and things, you know, coming up with the pandemic of something that we never really could foresee. But, you know, when I did my album with the quintet, there's a song on there called The Dreamer, where I talk about, you know, I never think there's going to be a rainy day ahead in my forecast, but then the good times don't last and I feel like an outcast. Like, I am not somebody that plans well for the future. Like, I'm kind of optimistic to a fault a lot of times. And so now it's been to, like, okay, there's a lot of real serious problems that are going on, and I just really need to get into the present moment. Like, everything's okay for right now. I don't know how next year is going to look. I don't know what's going to happen with the environment and society. But I'm okay today at this moment. And so that's why I get back to that one-on-one love of time with the family, connecting with my friends, opening up deeply to my wife, making sure that I'm really taking part in my support system, because it's like, shit's getting real.
Well, you know, it's funny because you allude to that feeling out of step. And you know, when you and I originally talked, I had said to you and wrote in the article that based on our interview that, you know, I was so taken with your cover of The Cure's Love Song. I mean, I think to a large degree, I wanted originally to interview because I was like, what on earth did you do? You know, and one of the things that we came to was that the Cure's version, which was, you know, majestic, obviously, in its own right, like it was this mournful vibe, and yours, 311's, wound up being hopeful, you know. So just in addition to being able, like, anyone who can do something with that song and you know, is such a great artistic feat. But what you're talking about that being out of step, it almost felt to me like that song symbolized it. Like, here was a song that so represented the vibe of the time. It was The Cure. It was there was the moodiness and all the things I love about The Cure, and I'm sure that you do too. But here was this band that was now taking that song and making it hopeful. And that was what we came to understand, was like, okay, that's what's different about the song. It's like brighter somehow. And I'm kind of curious for you. We talked about the concept of that heavy positivity, that idea that you're like, again, more optimistic sometimes than other people, and how that's developed for you and how that's manifesting now at a time when, like we said, it's like, man, this is a tough time to be positive.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for those comments. I think that when what we happened upon to achieve the Love Song cover is that extreme vulnerability of, you know, in the verses, admitting that like loneliness and yearning, but then getting to the choruses of like, however far away I will always love you, like that hope to this. So there's an arc that's going back and forth between, you know, loneliness and the solution, which is connection. So I think that's when you gotta really let your vulnerability open up in music, because people can sense that. People can sense the authenticity of when you're really feeling it. And I never wanted to manufacture emotions just to kind of fit in with what is like going on culturally, like just being true to yourself, do your own thing. And some people are like, they associate positivity with shallowness, because it's not just, you know, up with people, everything's great all the time. It's the struggle to look at the bright side of things, to keep from going too dark. I mean, the message of 311 is you know, basically sharing tools of self-preservation to have a good attitude, and to find a reason to feel hopeful. And reading Steven Pinker's book, all of his books was just such a huge inspiration to me about how to be, he doesn't call it optimism, but just how to having a scientific reason to think that life is actually going in a good direction, because we have not magnifying minds that want to focus on what's wrong in the world. And that has made us successful as a species, because we're always wanting to get better and build things bigger and improve. But that comes from our mind, a negativity bias. And so to hear a scientific person's kind of put out words that are kind of explain what I was feeling was kind of a good revelation, and kind of enforced what, you know, our attitude has always been in our lyrics.
Yeah. And so let's get to the how you do this, because again, you know, going back to the comparison with Love Song, it's like, you know, when I would listen to Robert Smith sing it, it was like, I just felt like, okay, I'm in a cave and I love this person, and there's just no way that person's ever going to love me. And you know what? I'm okay with it. And like, I kind of learned to live with it. And so you listen to that and you're like, okay, there's validation that there's someone out there who is defeated, but like there's some kind of solace in the defeat. Cause it, I guess it's like, you know, better to have loved and lost kind of a thing. And then the pivot with you guys, where it's like, you know, even the video, it's like, it's in a bar and there's people around and it's bright, and the hopeful part, you know, like the, I will always love you as an invitation. Right. And to use that metaphor for what I think you're talking about, just personally, how do you take that potential defeat, which is so easy to go into, you know, and turn it into like, well, maybe there's a chance here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I had been very attracted to not only The Cure, but also The Smiths, and where there was such open self-deprecation that of someone saying out these words, that we have all had these thoughts, like when Louder Than Bombs is such a good album. And this song, I Know I'm Unlovable, You Don't Have to Tell Me. Now, I'm not going to say I'm categorically unlovable, but at a certain point, we've all felt that way, that am I worthy? Self-doubt, questioning, self-loathing, you know, different things like that. I mean, I don't know if that's everyone's experience, but just for me, you know, admitting that those are thoughts that I have feels, I know I related to hear someone else say that first, and then to, so having that kind of vulnerability. I mean, we all crave relating. We want to relate. That's why we seek relationships. You know what I mean? My wife said that to me when we were first dating. I was like, that is so heavy. That is what art can provide for us, is to have that, you know, relating in a deep way. That sometimes just the written word, like if you just wrote the word sad, I know what sad means. But if you played some music that you were feeling when you were sad, that can express it and make people feel it much in such a deep way. It's a really a mysterious thing, the way music works, to be able to evoke emotion. And it's just like the never ending journey to try and further, deeper, more authentically express what you're going through.
And it's interesting, because I'm thinking as you're talking a lot about that original concept of what if, and how that can be so damaging. You know, what if something bad happens when I'm on stage? You know, what if there's a fire? You know, all these things. And then the transition to, but what if is used in a more hopeful way? You know, I'm feeling down, I'm feeling horrible, but what if this will end at some point? You know, what if I could find, like, I feel unlovable, but what if I could find love? And the more I'm thinking about it, the more I'm recognizing what you're talking about with music. I feel like every time we talk, I figure out why I like your version of love song more. It's like a personal journey of me figuring out why that song resonated with me so much. But one of the things that's different is that it's transformational. It's, you know, you're talking about music, but there's a lot of music out there that's fantastic. It's like wonderful music, but it doesn't move me from one place to another. It doesn't take me from sad to happy. I can listen to it and I can be like, hey, that's good music. It doesn't take me from validated, you know, unvalidated or invalidated to validated and hopeful. And I'm kind of curious, just from your perspective, like, because that's what I'm hearing as you're talking, is what's happening, like, at least for your process of music.
Yeah. And I think another important thing to mention is that 311 has decided it's okay to be joyful in a way that is, I don't know, not, I think we do joy better than, like, it's something that we just were like unapologetic about, of having these kind of like, you know, hippie sort of all you need is love type moments. Like, our very first single was called Do You Right. And it was just an expression of brotherly love. And people, it was just so out of sync with what was going on in 1993 when we put it out, that to me, I think I've mentioned in the lyrics a bunch of times, you got to have a full range of emotion. You got to be able to express completely your vulnerabilities and your hope and your, you know, your defects, and that people will hear that and people will relate. So, you know, having 13 albums under our belt, there's been so many things to say, but it feels like there's still more to say, especially now when there's just been such a unique set of circumstances has come up.
Well, you know, I think one of the things that you're saying that's so important, and this is, I think, important in therapeutic situations, but also just when we're managing ourselves, you know, going back to that anxiety, if you're sitting there and having catastrophic thoughts about something that might happen on stage, and you just tell yourself basically, oh, shut up, it'll be okay, right? That's not really hopeful, right? That's basically suppression. Right. And it's so important, like you said, that term, like appreciating the range of emotions. It's so important, whether it's therapeutically or just with yourself, to be able to say, no, I get that. Like I'm with you about all the things that could go wrong on stage and how potentially catastrophic it could be. I'm not saying that I don't see it. I'm saying I see it. I'm sitting there with you with it. And I'm just offering up the possibility that certain doom is not the only option, you know?
Yeah. I think that, and talking to somebody about it is such a important thing. I mean, this podcast of having musicians get this honest about, you know, with, you know, what problems that this probably wouldn't have existed 10 years ago, because there's just been so much, you know, more, destigmatization of mental health. I mean, I remember when Kevin Love came out and talked about panic attacks a few years ago, it was big news just for somebody that's operating at such a high level to get honest about something like that. But one person that was incredibly ahead of their times was Mr. Rogers. This guy was living in the future. And I was I grew up as a, you know, in the 70s as a, you know, a PBS kids kid, because there wasn't much kid programming on. And I love the Mr. Rogers show. And then to now to see both the Tom Hanks movie as well as the documentary and hear him talk about if it's mentionable, it's manageable, was such, I mean, because he would go there on his show of, you know, to talk about families breaking up, and people would be like, why do you want to bring this up in a kid show? He said, because this is what's going on. And if people can feel like it's okay to bring up these hard subjects, then they feel not so alone.
I know it's so funny, because like, and as far as someone who, like you said, was on the cutting edge, but even that, because you and I grew up in the same era, just like that basic fundamental premise, that mantra, like, won't you be my neighbor?
Yeah.
I mean, so that's so basic. And I remember, because, you know, that's just a phrase that makes total sense to me. I'd be very curious, like, what was the world like when people didn't grow up hearing that?
Yeah.
You know, because it's again, like, getting back to what we're talking about, it's not denying. And again, like, you know, like the 70s, like there's like the world was not necessarily a happy place back then. And he wasn't sitting here saying, and maybe refused to say, like, oh, it's all okay. He's not saying like, hey, everything's good, don't worry. You know, he's saying, just won't you be my neighbor, in the context of all that. That it is. It's like, it's very like subversively like powerful in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, how ballsy, for lack of a better word, it was to be that way in a time when, you know, in the 70s, when that was not the model of what men were supposed to do. And I love the Sopranos too, of the way, you know, Tony Soprano's main character was like, why can't we just be the strong silent type anymore? Because it doesn't work. You know what I mean? To have that vulnerability and to see when you try and suppress too much and pretend that nothing's wrong, that's when he was having those panic attacks. You know what I mean? So there's these, you know, little things in that both music, art, film can really, you know, open your eyes to where we need to move as a society.
And it's so interesting that you're saying that, because you're right. I mean, there were so many interesting arcs, obviously, in The Sopranos, but you're right. One of them that was so fascinating to watch was you were sitting there and you were just saying, you know, if this guy could just get mad at his mother, he wouldn't be flipping out. And I don't mean to belittle that, you know, kind of a thing in panic attacks, but you're right. Like as an illustration of an emotional process, it time and time again delivered on that fundamental thing that you're talking about here, which is that here's a guy who could not experience the range of emotions that was required to properly put into context all the horrible things that were happening in his life. And that's where the panic attacks came from.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it lets you know as a parent why you need to be why kids need approval so much, because when Tony Soprano didn't have that approval and had that criticism, it just messed everything up. So, you know, knowing with my kids today of just acknowledging their good deeds all the time, and, you know, and kids all have different levels of accomplishment. So, you know, sometimes you're patting them on the back for tiny little things, but just people need that pat on the back so much. Like it's, you know, parenting is such a trip, and just having, and also having that physical human contact. Like I remember, you know, reading the parenting books and hearing about 10 hugs a day, you know, because the oxytocin that both sides get from that bonding, you know, now we call it a cuddle puddle, like having, you know, the kids jump in the bed and, you know, watch an episode of The Simpsons or something like that. That safety, that human approval, that human contact, it's just so needed. And, you know, now we're just figuring out why it's so needed and what to do to get better at it.
And it's interesting, because one of the things, you know, when we were talking originally, what I see is this like heavy positivity, which I feel like is a book that I want you to write, you know. And one of the things that you talked about, whether it was your mom using the phrase love is a verb, or you using the term gratitude is an action, is the sense of the process, the appreciation and respect for the fact that you can't give a kid a hug once, you know, and have it be okay. Everything that we do in society that in theory is supposed to bring some kind of spiritual or emotional benefit, whether it's prayer or meditation or exercise or whatever it is that we do, writing, creativity, it is not something that you can just do once or twice and then, oh, you told me you loved me 10 years ago. I guess we're good. And I really appreciated the fact that you were very, very specific about how important it is that these things are actions, and they're ongoing actions.
Yeah. And I think when I talk to my friends about taking care of ourselves, I say, you know, facing our issues is a process of erosion, not surgery. It's like a repetitive thing that you have to do to take care of yourself. If, you know, I have self-criticism. I have had a problem with that of like, it's never enough. And that has driven me to do better. So I have to constantly counteract that with self-affirmations of, you know what, I did a good job today. I'm making the world a better place. And, you know, it's erosion, not surgery. You can't just like, all right, I figured it out, I'm fine. It's never going to be just one thing that you just solve it. You have to keep reminding yourself of those kind of affirmations.
And that's one of the things that's been so tough. You know, everyone, like when there's a movie about therapy or something, like, oh, you should watch this. I'm like, I do this every day. Like, I don't want to watch a movie or a TV show really about therapy. The Sopranos was like the only one that I really did, and maybe a little bit of Monk. But like, the thing that's always so frustrating to me is that it's such great cinema, the idea that you're going to have this one moment that's going to change everything. It's theatrical and it's dramatic, and it's almost this like collusion that we all do. It's like, it's so great for me as a therapist if I could bring you to that one moment that's gonna, you know, I have that magic, and it's amazing for you because then it's over and you're better. And, you know, just like to agree with what you're saying, it's like it just doesn't happen that way, and it's so dangerous for people to believe that it does, because then they don't know how to orient to the ongoing nature of managing something like anxiety.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a never ending journey to keep those kind of self care things. And there was a time around the Uplifter album when I was super into The Power of Now and Eckhart Tolle, and just like super into, I went to Buddhist meetings and things like that. And then I just, I started having kids, I basically, all my care was focused on them. But now in the pandemic, I've realized like I have to carve out a little more time for my own self-care, and then getting, so now just doing some meditations each day because of this, like, you know, fear mongering, disaster baiting, you can call it, like,
nice.
to turn the mental tide around is not something that you can like let a therapist all of a sudden say one thing and the lights will come on. It's through a repetitive series of action that you have to turn this big ship towards where you want to go.
And it gets back to even that process that you were talking about at the beginning, that simple but devastating process of my mind spinning and I'm not sleeping. Right. Yeah. And that's something that a lot of times when you're younger, you know, a lot of people don't sleep or they sleep at weird hours, but you see how insidious mental health issues can be when something that could even be a minor anxiety process and you're having trouble sleeping and all of a sudden you're that cranky guy in the morning and all of a sudden, like, you know, you're barking at your kids a little, and I'm saying this from me being that guy often, you know, you're barking at your kids, you're a little less, like, you know, tolerant with your spouse, and you look back and you're like, wow, like I've been kind of like the stress in this house for a while, and yeah. All of a sudden your life is different, and it all came from that small, like, seemingly simple and under the radar anxiety experience that you weren't quite sure was such a big deal. But then you look back and you're like, wow, this has been undermining me for like a long time.
Sure. And in also rewinding the tape even further before the hard night of sleep, like I mentioned that I would go through these peaks and valleys of, I don't know, mood or the swings, whatever you want to call it. But obviously I want to be in that good mood. So you naturally find ways to keep yourself moving slightly towards the mania side, where whether it's like through tons of caffeine or, you know, some cannabis or whatever, like once if you figure out how to stay on the mania side, you are going to have to crash sometimes. And that's why people get into this, you know, self-medication. Like you can force, you can create a mania through hard drugs, and where that you're going to crash hard. So keeping, you know, control of vices is important. And then what you said, when you realize that you're being really cranky, to tell your loved ones, you know what, I'm having a bit of a tough time right now. This is not exactly how I want to be, to make that amends. You know, that feels good to get that out.
It's, I mean, I knew, cause I mean, you know, for most of my early life, I mean, I never really was a heavy drinker in terms of frequency, but whenever I did, it was always intense, and it was, and all of a sudden I was looking back and I'm like, you know, I'm getting into this cycle where, like, and I don't even notice it, like where I'm out all night and you're talking about that manic. It's like when I would get a few drinks in me, I just felt awesome. And like, you know, everything seemed to, like, puffed up, and like I could take on the world, and this is fantastic, and it was great. And then I just didn't notice that the next day I was a wreck, because I just kind of was like already focused on, oh, I'm just going to rest up so I can go out the next night and have that same experience. And it felt fun, and it was fun, but I knew right before I met my wife, I was like, I can't do this. There's no way she's going to tolerate this. Like, I mean, I don't mean her, like, I don't think anybody's going to tolerate this. And, you know, I have no idea how I would ever be able to do that and then have kids.
Yeah.
Because so much of it is being able to be there in the morning, like not the way, at least I used to be in those times.
Yeah. I think when you're young, you have this illusion that you can sort of cheat karma by having, you know, the yin without the yang. And then at some point you realize, like, you got to pay the piper at some point. So you can't, you know, manufacture such intense highs without really paying for it with lows. So now as I go on, just getting into the self-care of, like, noticing how much better I feel when I have exercise, when I have, you know, check-ins with people, when I have some, all these different, you know, self-care now, like I said, getting back into meditation, like those are the kind of things that work to improve your mindset without a huge cost to pay.
Now let me make a distinction between two types of self-care, and maybe one is self-care and one's not. So there's the self-care that stabilizes us. And then there's like, okay, so let's say, for example, it's like, okay, you know, somebody's drinking heavily or doing drugs or whatever. And then you're offering up to them. It's like, well, you know, take care of yourself a little bit more. There are certain things that meditation or exercise or getting regular sleep, eating healthy, that kind of smooth us out. But then the question becomes, do those in and of themselves produce those highs that you're kind of giving up if you're going to lead a healthier lifestyle? You know, because like a lot of people will say, well, I'm more stable, I'm clearer, I'm like, you know, I'm healthier, but I miss those like elated, crazy elated moments. And I don't even mean the word crazy from a mental health perspective. I mean, from a like, you know, nightlife or like whatever kind of perspective.
Yeah. A breakthrough for me is when I heard I guess you maybe a slogan, but if you want self-esteem, you have to do esteemable acts. So, and I think that needs to be a combination of stuff of taking care of yourself, but also taking care of other people. And to me, you know, there were times where I was not happy with the way that I was living and what I was just really lacking that self-esteem. So just getting into, you know, growing up to take better care of myself and realize that kind of self-esteem is almost the whole ball of wax when it comes to happiness, to feeling good about yourself. I mean, if they could have a pill that was give you self-esteem, I would definitely buy stock in that pharmaceutical company, because that is such the important thing in how we feel about ourselves. But there's really no shortcuts. It's about doing acts that make you feel good about yourself, taking care of yourself and others. And also, you know, not being in a total routine. Like, I can't be Mr. I'm perfect, I'm going to work all the time. Like, you know, last night we were doing our Halloween celebration. I was like, let's go candy. Let's just, you know, I'm not prescribing like a monk, like, life at all, but just, you know, having those self-care actions that are also taking care of other people is so important.
I mean, that's the thing that I think is so tough. You know, you mentioned that concept of unlovable, and I'll get so many people I work with who will say things like, oh, I'm afraid I'm unlovable. And I try to say, I was like, listen, like that doesn't really mean anything, you know, because everybody is lovable if they want to put their love into action. You know, and it's like, okay, like, and they're like, well, you know, what is that? What is that? It's like, well, you know, I think it was Keanu Reeves. I hope I'm not misquoting, but he had this super interesting quote about how even when he's alone, like how he takes care of himself, like he gets himself food and he buys himself clothes. And there was this, what I loved about it was this concept of thinking about being in a relationship with yourself first.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And it's like, well, if you want to, it's not about, are you unlovable or lovable? That's a static concept. It's just like what you're saying. It's like, it's just like getting up and saying like, well, how can I engage in loving acts on different levels?
Yeah. And, that whole concept reminds me of, Billie Eilish's song, My Future, and how she is, I have three daughters, so that music is on a lot. Not only the vocal performance and the cool chords and like the funky jazz that's going on underneath it, but just the whole concept of like kind of dating yourself and just being in love with your future. And I know I'm supposed to be unhappy because I'm not in a relationship, but aren't I someone? You know, it's really, really powerful stuff. Good for girls, especially, to hear.
Well, and I think back to it, and I say this to, you know, anybody I'm working with, it's like, when I look back on how things went in my life, either good or bad, it almost always comes back to, well, like, what was I doing? Like, was I connecting with myself? Like, you know, I know the work that I like to do. Was I into it? You know, I know the way I like to exercise. Was I into it? I know how I like to connect with my friends. And all of that before you necessarily get to that binary, well, am I in a relationship or have I found love? And it's so important, as you know, getting back again to this idea of like, how do we care for ourselves when we're struggling with our mental health? I'm curious your thoughts on it, but I would definitely say to everyone, you know, start there if possible.
Yeah. Yeah. And I had identified in myself that in the old days that I was afraid to be alone because I needed somebody there to tell me that everything's okay. So being that person, because now, you know, I go out when you're a touring musician, you have such a night and day of like home life where you're always with your family to touring life, where all of a sudden it's like all this me time. From no me time of having three kids and a wife and pets and everything to take care of, to nothing to take care of except myself, where I all of a sudden I'm like, okay, now I'm going to step up my self-care of like kind of doing a checklist. Like those are kind of my happiest times of when I'm okay. I've done my exercise. I'm going to, you know, work on my guitar playing. I'm going to eat good. I'm going to make those calls, even if I don't feel like it, like use that contrary action to say, I'm going to pick up the phone, even if it seems really heavy, because even though you're around people all the time on tour, it's so surface that you need to sometimes like make yourself have a deeper conversation with not only family members, but also guys that are in a, like in a kind of parallel life. So, it's a never ending journey to figure out how to do it right.
I'm always amazed when I hear the stories of how much a musician's lifestyle seems singularly designed to destroy one's emotional and physical well-being. Like it is everything about what we as a society ask of our rock stars is, you know, like being away from home for months, years at a time, like, you know, traveling in the middle of the night, having all these bizarre sleep schedules, you know, and even this thing that you're talking about, like, you know, what do you do if you're on a, you know, 100-day tour and on the third one, you're a little bit anxious about getting on stage? It's like, what, you know, in for a lot of people, like we can take a little time, you know, we can sort of say like, all right, let me work on this. But, you know, you guys have to do this. You have to perform in some cases, no matter what. And to be honest, like, I don't know how sympathetic a lot of the fans, I mean, now I think much more. Now I think it's like to the point that you were saying before, now I think it would be much different. Like if you came out and said, hey, I'm struggling with something, with anxiety, I think people would be much more supportive. But back when you were starting, nobody ever said that. People were like, you're anxious. You know, I remember what happened when Eddie Vedder like had a situation where he had to leave stage. It was like international news. He was like, yeah. The guy was sick as a dog. And Pearl Jam is one of those, at least from my understanding of, is one of those real, you know, like they put all their into their shows and I don't remember them ever missing anything before. And one time, and everybody went ballistic on him. And that to me is just like, wow, that is what a pressure, you know?
Yeah. No, you'll have people, certain people, it's all poor rock star and, you know, mock you, but, you know, all we can ever hope to be is human, and it's becoming more and more okay to be human. As I definitely see that things are going in the right direction with just people waking up to preconceived notions that are wrong, you know, whether it's sexism or all these different things, racism, like there's just such a beautiful awakening going on. There is reason to be hopeful about society, but then the thing is that every time we uncover something that's wrong, then it just, it's like you're seeing so many more things that we still have so much further to go. And then And then everyone argues about, is this really a problem or not? And you know, it's like, you just have to be true to yourself.
Well, and it's also, I think, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, again, like, you know, why this podcast? You know, in part, it's because we're all fascinated with the people who, you know, create these moments in our lives. You know, it's like you and I have only talked a couple of times, but I've listened to your music for years. So it's like this important thing in my life. And it's very, very damaging. And I think it really perpetuates the stigma of mental illness when somebody struggles with something like addiction or depression or, you know, had a trauma and people treat them horribly in whatever form on a public stage. You know, it's like, you know, oh, that person's an addict. It's like, what do you think everybody else who's an addict is now thinking? Like, oh, I want to go out and I want to really get help. You know, no, they're going to be like, I don't want anyone to know this because I don't want people to mock me or shame me or make me feel bad the way that they're making this person who's publicly struggling with something.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's there's more, it's more safer to admit your problems now. And that's a good thing, but you know, it's a tough journey. And I think that's where a lot of my anxiety came from, as you went from unknown, super ambitious, unknown band to all of a sudden the glare of the spotlight of like, wait, I always wanted to be here, but now do I really deserve this? Am I really worthy of being here? And then because I have so much self-criticism, that was where the anxiety was coming from for me. Like, am I going to be able to handle this spotlight of everything that I worked so hard for or not? But there's no quick and easy answer. So that's when I had to really like say, okay, I need some help with this. And then it got better.
Well, listen, you know, just I'm looking at the time and I just want to make sure, did we miss anything? Did we cover all the important bases?
We covered a lot. You know, I love talking about this stuff because it's just, like I said, the never ending journey. So I had no idea where we were going to go. So it's fun. We covered some cool territory and hopefully some people out there would relate.
Well, listen, it's always great talking with you. And, I very much appreciate you stepping up. And I think I'm saying thanks on behalf of everybody who's out there because look, you don't have to do this. Like, you know, you don't have to step up and be vulnerable and share these issues and talk about your process. You know, people would be perfectly okay with you just playing great music. And so when somebody like you steps up, is that many more people who are thinking to themselves, you know, oh, you know, maybe I can get better. You know, maybe I can go another day. Maybe I can, like, you know, it's okay.
Reach out.
Yeah. And it's so very grateful, my man. And so thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me again.
Appreciate the kind words, Dr. Mike. Good to talk to you again.
All right. Take care. So there it is. Nick Hexum of 311 talking about how he experiences anxiety, the factors that contribute to his being more anxious, and how he copes. Now, there's a lot to learn from Nick here. One of the first things is the way Nick describes his anxiety as mind spinning. And Nick explained how when his mind spins, he often falls into a cycle of racing thoughts, poor sleep, and anxiety. It's important to remember that even though we all struggle with our mental health at times, the way we struggle may be very different. And the more we can examine and understand the way something like anxiety specifically manifests in our life, the better chance we have of coping. One of the factors that Nick describes as making his anxiety worse is what he calls future tripping, that unfortunate habit we can get into where we look too far into the future so we get anxious about something that may or may not happen later in our lives and don't focus on living our life in the here and now. And just like when I spoke with him originally, I was once again struck by Nick's dedication to his active and ongoing process of working on anxiety and mental health that includes therapy, focusing on how to understand and tolerate negative emotions, and working to find healthier and more adaptive ways of thinking. An important takeaway from Nick's insights can be that for all of us, mental health is a verb. Anything that we do in our lives that brings us joy or satisfaction, be it prayer, work, healthy eating, meditation, being kind to others, it must be something that we don't just do once and forget about. To get the full results, we have to do these things daily over the course of our lives to get the effect we want. And it's the same with mental health. One concrete thing we can do to improve our overall mental health is to choose something that we think is going to help us cope with mental illness, develop it as a skill, and make it a habit. Maybe we start getting therapy regularly, or start taking medication. Maybe we keep an active list of things for which we are grateful in this world. Or maybe we just reach out to friends and loved ones and share our story to help reduce our own internal stigma of mental illness. I want to thank Consequence Podcast Network and SoundMind Live for including me in this wonderful project, which is sponsored by Janssen Pharmaceutical Companies of Johnson & Johnson. And thanks to Pete Wilson and the Rooks for letting us use their song, I Know. So be healthy, be safe, and be kind to yourself and others. See you next time at the Crossroads.
Consequence Podcast Network.